Welcome to episode 108 of the Highly Relevant Podcast, a U.S. Latino show where I interview the people and discuss the moments that are shaping our American and Latino pop culture. I am your host, Jack Rico, and if this is your first time listening, thanks for discovering us. All right, guys, today is the reason why I created this podcast. It's to be able to have the freedom to talk about U.S. Latino stories like this week's cancellation of One Day at a Time by Netflix. It's causing uproar amongst U.S. Latinos and Americans alike, and it's mostly been driven by the fans and the press. I mean, people are literally pissed off at this cancellation. They've gone at Netflix for being a bunch of hypocrites, for saying they support diversity and inclusion, but then do things like this. So I had a chance to talk to Marielena Fernandez. She's the TV reporter for New York Magazine and Vulture.com. And she joins me to discuss how this cancellation might actually detour progress that's been made for U.S. Latino TV shows. Is our culture slowly being deleted? Well, I talked to her about it. Then I talked to Concepcion de Leon. She's the New York Times writer who pitched and created their first ever Latinx column called El Space. How did it come to be? Did she encounter any resistance from editors? What's been the feedback so far? We have an interesting conversation on identity, writing, and how she broke into the business. But first, let's talk One Day at a Time.
Since Sid identifies as non-binary, I want to call them by a term that's more acceptable and inclusive.
Oh, you know what I always thought was so cute? Better half.
I don't want to call Sid half a person. What if I tell people you're my better whole?
You're not saying that.
I have on the phone right now Marielena Fernandez. She's the TV reporter for New York Magazine and Vulture.com. She's out of LA right now. And just like her and myself, we're very, very sad at the fact that One Day at a Time has been canceled by Netflix. And I believe that it started trending almost immediately online. Isn't that crazy?
It is crazy. You know, for the last few weeks, there's been a Save One Day at a Time campaign, you know, that the writers and producers of the show started, and all of its big fans, you know, people like Lin-Manuel Miranda and other famous people have been like pushing for the renewal. And today we woke up to the sad news that Netflix decided to cancel it. But the campaign moves on because Sony, who produces the show, has vowed to try to sell it to another network. And we've seen in the recent past that shows have been saved. You know, Brooklyn Nine-Nine had a very passionate fan base and people rallied and NBC decided to pick it up. And so, you know, fingers crossed. But so far today has been a sad, sad day. You know,
yeah, we're like mourning. We're like in mourning. It's like a funeral out there.
Yes. When you read Rita Moreno's tweets about grieving her character and you read Norman Lear's statement about being heartbroken, you know, these are people that are legends in our culture, right? And you and they're elderly and you see the impact that it's having on them. How can it not have impact on you? You know, as Latinos in the United States, we don't have much representation on television in the form of a show like One Day at a Time. You know, every once in a while we have a character here or there on a TV series, but shows that center around our family life and our cultures are rare. And, you know, I'm Cuban American and the show is based on a Cuban American family. And I've never seen that before, you know, other than Que Pase USA back in the day.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Yeah, I've never seen this on a U.S., you know, English language show. And, you know, not that that's the only reason that the show is worthy, because the show is very funny and emotional and has many topics that many families can relate to in terms of, you know, a gay child or a parent in the military who's suffering from PTSD or taking care of a parent. You know, there's many things that are across the board relatable. But, you know, the bonus for you and me is that we see ourselves, you know, in little details. It's not even, you know, that they're spending the entire half hour screaming, I'm Cuban. It's just you see the cafetera on the stove and you see them eating pastelitos or arguing about Che Guevara or, you know, and those are conversations I've never heard of and wish I had had when I was growing up. So that's why I think the Latinx community in particular is really, really sad today.
I thought it was the Latinx community exclusively, but the biggest sort of voices that have been very vocal about this have been Caucasian journalists.
Yeah.
From Variety, from TV, I mean, from almost everywhere. They almost seem to be more outraged than we.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the show is a total media darling. I mean, it's been on every top 10 list at the end of the year since it came on Netflix. And yeah, I didn't mean to say that we're the only ones in mourning. I'm just saying, you know, why we specifically would be. But yes, the show has been very successful in terms of
reaching other audiences. Because, you know, somebody on Twitter recently said that, yeah, we finally had a show that was made by Latinos for Latinos. And I'm like, you know what? That should be tweaked. This is a show made by Latinos for everyone. And that has been sort of the master template of how to create Latino stories, but that can be digestible for anyone of any background. And I think that's one of the reasons that the outrage has been so intense is because, as you said before, Rotten Tomatoes had it at 100% for the last three seasons. Everybody and anybody who saw it was talking about how incredible the writing was, how incredibly touching and emotional and connected with so many people. And then you have to really ask yourself whether Netflix, if this is the hypocrisy of Netflix, because in a statement that they made on Twitter, and let me just quote it really quick so everybody understands the context here. And to anyone who felt seen or represented possibly for the first time by One Day at a Time, please don't take this as an indication your story is not important. The outpouring for the outpouring of love for this show is a firm reminder to us that we must continue finding ways to tell these stories. And the first thing I'm like thinking about is, you condescending guys. How are you saying this and canceling it all at the same time?
That's a total slap in the face. And if I remember correctly, one of the tweets also mentioned low ratings, which, you know, they're supposed to be the platform that doesn't care about ratings.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think this show was really canceled?
What I have heard behind the scenes is that it didn't perform well internationally. As you know, Netflix is in 190 countries. It's not just measuring U.S. audience. And so what I've heard is that internationally it hasn't performed, and they've been concerned about that since, you know, between the second season and third season renewal, which also took very long and seemed like it was going to be canceled last year.
Right.
And then they decided to give it an extra go. But, you know, there's other ways to look at that, too. You know, they have an extraordinary amount of money for programming. I mean, every week we're seeing new shows on Netflix. And sometimes when shows are prestigious and do very well in terms of media attention and bring something different to the table, networks will opt to keep them, even if they are not performing as well as they would like them to, you know, in viewership, because they bring a certain cachet and a certain prestige and something special to the table. And so, you know, you're seeing a lot of critics bringing that up. You know, there were a lot of other reasons, many more important reasons to keep it. So that, I think, is why everyone is so sore.
Right.
I mean, that's why you're seeing everybody so upset today.
Now, I have to ask these questions because these are the questions that immediately went through my mind. And I'm curious to knowing what your thoughts on it are. Would One Day at a Time have continued for another season if the cast was white or if the cast was black?
I would tend to think so. You know, I would tend to think that at the very least, there would have been a likelihood of them saying, you're getting six more episodes to finish your story.
Right.
You know, the fact that they just decided to cancel it, and, you know, I don't want to spoil it, so I'm not going to say what it is, but the end of season three is a cliffhanger. You know, for them not to get to tell that story and end it and say goodbye to these characters after they've been received as well as they have, you know, it really doesn't make any sense. There's been many, many instances where a network says, you know, we don't think we can support this show anymore beyond three or four more episodes so that you can close it out. And that at least makes the fans happy. The producers get to tell the story they wanted to tell. You know,
yeah, there's closure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really hard, you know, when Lydia is you know where at the end of season three and we don't know what happened.
Oh, absolutely. You know, like I also keep on asking questions like, was the show properly promoted by Netflix? Why didn't it get the Roma treatment?
That is another huge and very important point. You don't see the One Day at a Time billboards on Sunset Boulevard in Netflix.
Right.
And I've talked to many of the show, of the actors' representatives who say it's very hard to get their actors on talk shows. Just, this was the first
season.
This was the first season that a talk show took Rita Moreno and Justina Machado. And, like, they just couldn't, I mean, that a talk show would not want Rita Moreno is, like,
it's bonkers, right? But right? But maybe it's Rita Moreno under the context of a Hispanic U.S. sitcom.
Exactly.
Because once West Side Story with Steven Spielberg comes out, because Rita Moreno's, I'm sure everyone's going to want Rita Moreno to talk about West Side Story.
That's exactly the thing. You know, the promotion and marketing of the show hasn't been there. So there, you know, some of the outlets on the national level aren't that aware of it. You know, the people that are booking the talk shows aren't aware of, like, the significance of the show. And they're just like, oh, that's just a little show on Netflix. It doesn't matter that it's Rita Moreno. You know, if you don't promote it and you don't market it, and, you know, the producers have done yeoman's work on social media, you know, rallying people and establishing relationships with fans. And, you know, they had a food truck in LA for the premiere where they were giving out Cuban food and, you know, saying hi to fans, because the Netflix just wouldn't do that for them.
What happens now with U.S. Latino stories moving forward? And I'm not just talking about Netflix, because I think Netflix, this was a complicated thing for them. I mean, this was like its own sort of a unicorn that they didn't exactly know what to do. It was a hybrid of so many different things coalesced in one show that I'm sure even metrics had nothing to do with it. This was far bigger than what data can tell you. I know that they double down on Latin American stories in Spanish language. I think that's much perhaps probably easier to sell internationally than One Day at a Time in English with Hispanics, where maybe Latin Americans can't connect with that American experience, right? Or even the Caribbean experience from Cuba. If you live, for example, in Argentina, right? So the question I think for me is, all the cable channels, all the streaming services, all the broadcast networks in the United States, they look at this and are they like, oh my God, that has, tiene la plaga encima. You know, it got the cooties right now. Everybody stay away from U.S. Latino stories. They don't work. And look at the outrage by everybody. Do we want to tackle something like that? What do you think programmers today are thinking about U.S. Latino stories? Is this a bad moment for us moving forward?
You know, it definitely doesn't help our cause. You know, one of the reasons it stands out is because it doesn't exist, right? And it doesn't exist because, for the most part, U.S. programmers don't know what to do with us. Because even in the U.S. Latino population, we have so many differences, right? We have regional differences. We have cultural differences between, like, Cuban and Mexican and Puerto Rican. And they want to treat us as one group, but we're not all going to respond the same way, right?
Oh, marketers hate us. They're like, I don't know what to do with you.
Yeah. So, you know, by and large, they just have ignored us, you know, and for, I think in the last year or so, you're seeing that Latinx Hollywood is trying to unite more. You know, they've been inspired by what Black Hollywood has been able to do.
And Asian Hollywood too, yeah.
Yeah, in terms of breaking out, you know, in film and TV. And what they've learned is that they have to create their own stories. You know, as you know, one of the co-creators of One Day at a Time is Gloria Calderon Kellett, and the show could not exist without her.
Absolutely. And Mike Royce, right.
And so, you know, you're seeing that more of them are becoming, you know, actors are becoming directors and producers, because, you know, people like America Ferrera and Gina Rodriguez, because they know that's the way to get more stories on the air. It's not just them getting a role. But it's going to be very hard. I think you're right that the fact that one day at a time is going to be perceived as a failure really hurts the community.
I'll tell you a solution that I think is going to ultimately happen, and it's not necessarily something that we want or like, but it's going to be, I think, the future of Hispanic programming. My wife said this to me. We're going to live in a world one day where there are going to be no more verticals. It's not going to be a Hispanic site for Latinos. It's all going to be one big sopa, right? Where the next couple of shows that you see with Hispanics, it's going to be a Hispanic lead with a white or black or Asian co-lead. And then kind of like Ugly Betty, where it had its own Latino storyline, but it didn't necessarily affect the whole show with its Hispanic broad stroke, right? Brushstroke.
Right.
And it's going to be a combination of all diversities into one show where maybe Hispanics might have the upper hand in terms of plot lines or star actors or something along those lines, because then it can be consumed and everyone can connect with those characters. So maybe, and you know, these are questions we have to ask because we have to understand why this did not happen.
Right.
What are the particular questions that we need to ask to improve the situation as opposed to constantly being angry that we're not being represented?
Well, I think, I mean, there's value in both ways of looking at this. You know, there's value in having a family that's very specific Latino and having that representation on television. And there's value in having two kick-ass female cops on Brooklyn Nine-Nine that are both Latina, but don't their stories and their character development is not about their culture. It's about they are in the precinct and their work, and they have their quirks, and they just exist because, like you and I, we exist in the world, right? We don't spend our day going, "I'm Latino, I'm Latino."
Yeah, we're not professional Latinos, right?
Yeah, in everything we're doing. So, you know, it's the same. If you look at the success of Black Hollywood, you know, you can have a Black person be a lead in a show that has nothing to do with their race, or you can have a show as successful as Insecure or Atlanta, you know, that really speaks to the Black experience in a very, very specific way, and that other people can find things to relate to about it. So I don't think it's either or, you know. I hope that there's going to be room for us to be able to tell our own specific special stories, because I think that's the brilliance of One Day at a Time, you know?
It worked well on Broadway, where Lin-Manuel Miranda was able to tap into something universal within the Heights.
Yes.
And I've always thought that that would have been a great TV show. I know they're trying to adapt it to a film right now. Right. I believe it's with either Warner Brothers or Universal Studios, and that's fine, but it's like a one and gone, and we won't see it afterwards. I think a TV show would be great about, you know, Usnavi and his Washington Heights, you know, trying to get back to the Dominican Republic with the lottery ticket. I think there's something there that he was able to do so well. So it's not that U.S. Latino stories don't work. It's just that, and this is the part that I have troubles with, because, I mean, I'm not a screenwriter. You know, I don't know exactly what he did that maybe Gloria missed or maybe was ignored by the gatekeepers.
Yeah, I don't know that it's something that Gloria missed, you know, because when you watch that show has something for everyone. I think it is a question of, was it promoted as much as it should have been? You know, was there enough awareness created around it? And then there's this issue that it was on this platform that looks at things beyond the U.S. audience and the U.S. interest in a show. They do look at the international interest.
Bueno, María Elena Fernández, TV reporter for New York Magazine and Vulture.com. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking a little bit about One Day at a Time and its cancellation and sort of the bigger repercussions of what this means. So once again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
And before we head on to our interview with Concepcion, it's time for a segment I like to call Jacked In. Let's begin with the top movie news of the week. Esai Morales joins the DC Universe as villain Deathstroke. Denzel Washington to star in Warner Brothers cop thriller Little Things. Antonio Banderas has joined the Hitman's Bodyguard sequel with Salma Hayek. And watch Oscar Isaac in Netflix's new original film, Triple Frontier, starring Ben Affleck, out now. In TV news, Rosario Dawson will voice Netflix's forthcoming animated series, The Last Kids on Earth. Netflix will make Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Cien Años de Soledad into a TV series. And actress Susan Santiago will star as a series regular opposite Brooke Shields in the CW's drama pilot, Glamorous. Switching over to music, J Balvin and Selena Gomez have a new music video, I Can't Get Enough. The first ever Premios de Música Urbana will air on Telemundo on Thursday, March 21st. Enrique Iglesias and John Z premiered Después Que Te Perdí music video, and CNCO and Karol G are among those who will perform at the 2019 Billboard Latin Music Awards. And in tech and social media news, Twitter made an in-app camera to compete with Instagram and Snapchat. Apple reportedly close to adding HBO, Showtime, and Stars to a future upcoming video service. Instagram rolls out option to pause all notifications, and all Spotify premium subscribers will now get Hulu for free. If you haven't noticed yet, the New York Times has a brand new Latin X column called El Space. It's courtesy of Dominican-American Concepcion de Leon, a writer for the book section of the Times. We talk why she came up with the idea to pitch it to her editors, the importance of the column for her culture and community, and how she got hired at America's most prestigious newspaper. Concepcion de Leon, welcome to the Highly Relevant Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So what exactly is El Space from the New York Times?
So El Space is a column that I started last year. And essentially, it's a space in which it has a sort of a newsletter setup. And so it has a story up top that I either report or kind of write an essay based on issues that are occurring in the news during like that particular week, or issues that are relevant to Latino communities that week. And so I write that, and then I suggest, you know, a group of articles that would also be interesting to Latino viewers. Mm-hmm. I mean, not Latino viewers, excuse me, Latino readers.
And so are you the editor? Are you the conceptual editor of what goes on it? Or do people pitch you things and then you have to take that to another editor who then approves the topic that you're going to be writing about?
So I would say right now I'm the writer of it. So I write the column. I select the stories that I want to recommend or the videos, whatever it might be. And then I have two top editors who I work with that then kind of look at it and tell me if there's anything that I need to tweak and do a lot more sort of line editing. But in terms of the curation of it, that's all me.
What triggered the idea for El Space to be created? Was it you that came up with the concept and pitched it to New York Times editors? Or did they approach you with it? And why was the timing right?
So It was me that pitched it, and I pitched it to our as a special project, and I kind of the way that it came up was that we have a Spanish version of the Times called El Times, and they have a newsletter, and when they were kind of revamping their newsletter last year, I was one of the people that was kind of reading it and giving sort of some comments on it, and I read that and I was like, wow, it'd be so cool if we had something similar to this in the United States. I feel like the Spanish speaking population in the U.S. is really neglected, and Latinos as a whole, but we sort of forget that the United States has the second largest population of Spanish speakers in the world, you know, and that's really significant. And so I felt like we were really neglecting a huge population of people within the U.S. because I should mention also that El Times is more so catered like to Latin America. So it's news that's really relevant in that region. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of articles that we were publishing related to Latinos in the U.S. that weren't necessarily being translated. And I felt like that was a hole that could be filled. And so I pitched El Space as a way to sort of directly speak to that audience, but also to kind of increase the number of articles that we're translating into Spanish. And I should mention that, you know, kind of unbeknown to me at the time, there was a sort of greater strategy in terms of reaching Spanish-speaking audiences. That is definitely a priority for the New York Times. And so I think it just so happened that I pitched this at a time when it was also becoming more of a point of interest for the Times as a whole.
Got it. So the timing was perfect. Now, El Space, as I understand it, it's in English, not in Spanish, correct?
So it's, I write it in English, yeah, but it's translated every week and published in Spanish as well on our Spanish language vertical.
Did you show any data to have to convince anybody that this was the right move to make? Did you have to do like a whole research project, a PowerPoint or a keynote presentation? Guys, yeah. Let me educate you, please. Listen, the data doesn't lie.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of excitement for it from the beginning, I think. But we did have to, you know, I had to submit a proposal, and I worked with someone that does like audience development to sort of look for data to back up things that I sort of felt to be true anecdotally, mm-hmm. Which is that there is a huge bilingual population in the U.S., that, you know, there is a particular interest in this kind of content. And so, yeah, I mean, for sure, there was research that went into it. It was, I think it took about 6 months to actually get it up and running.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so it wasn't, you know, from one day to the other. There was sort of a lot of research and stuff that went into it. But I would say that there was a lot of support and kind of just like excitement about it from the beginning.
That's great. You know, for me, as a reader of the New York Times for years, and as a Latinx and as a bilingual, bicultural person, I always wanted to read more Hispanic stories and hear from more Hispanic journalists that had a point of view. So, for example, in my particular case, I've always had an issue with how certain, let's say, Latino movies that are coming out, like, for example, Coco, and there's a non-Hispanic critic writing about it. And I've always said, yeah, it'd be nice if a Latino got that same sort of, you know, sort of look. I always thought that the New York Times saw Hispanics more as an afterthought in terms of stories because they're not valuable to the majority of their readership, which is mostly white or black. And I always felt that I was either A, invisible, B, completely ignored, and that my voice or my life experience never really mattered. And by the way, this is coming from a guy that grew up in New York, that didn't learn Spanish till he was 15, that is completely assimilated from birth, and probably considers himself more American than Hispanic at some points. And I've been thinking about this for years. So what do you think conflated everything together to create this time and moment where LS Space can actually exist within the brand of the New York Times?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think it's been a long time coming. I don't want to sort of create the impression that I feel like LS Space is all that's being done, because I think that it's a part of sort of a much bigger conversation. You know, there's this sort of, I don't know if you've read all of the coverage about the Oscars and Alfonso Cuarón's win, but it's significant, you know, that in the last, I think, 6 years, a Mexican director has won 5 out of 6 times,
right?
You know, and that's exciting. And I think, again, that's something that's a long time coming. Those are 3 directors that have been working, you know, in Hollywood and elsewhere for decades. And so I think it's sort of the same thing at the Times and in other places where this has sort of been brewing for a long time, in terms of hiring more writers of color, hiring more Latino writers, so that they can bring those voices in, because you just sort of don't know what you don't know, you know? And I think what you're saying about feeling underrepresented, feeling unseen, is something that I've heard from a lot of people who are reading LS Space and are excited about it and feeling that their stories are finally being represented. And I think the value of LS Space is that it is it is sort of specifically catered for a Latino community. Like, I think that we do stories about Latinos, not enough. Admittedly, definitely not enough, but we do stories about Latinos often but we don't sort of get them in front of the right people. We don't get them to the right audiences, because maybe the New York Times isn't viewed as a place where people might come for that. And I think that that's something that that's kind of the hole that I think LS Space fills, is sort of like being an inviting place where people can be like, look, we're here and we're sort of trying to produce more content and sort of make the New York Times feel like a place where Latinos belong. Or at least that's what I'm trying to do, I guess I should say. And I think it just takes time, you know, it's tough. I don't really see it as this like major shift over the last like year or 2 years. I see it as something that like has slowly been trudging forward mm-hmm. over the last like decades, and finally is feels like something is happening, and hopefully that'll continue to grow, you know.
What is your cultural background?
I'm Dominican.
You're Dominican. You know, it's interesting. How many Dominicans do you know work either in the New York Times or in major outlets like the Journal? Do you have colleagues that are Dominican that work in the mainstream press?
We have some. Sandra Garcia, I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but she's a reporter on our Express desk, which is a desk that does a lot of our breaking news coverage. She's really, really talented and has been here longer than I have, actually, mm-hmm. Though I'm not exactly sure exactly how long. I think it might be like 3 or 4 years. So she's really great, a really talented person. And then we have, I don't know of any other reporters, and I hope I'm not wrong about that, but there are definitely other people that are working across the building. Claudio Cabrera mm-hmm. is an SEO specialist, and so he works on the SEO team to sort of try to get our stories into the right, in front of the right people. So there are a few. There, you know, it's Dominicans, I think, are a smaller... a minority of a minority, I think. You know, I think in New York there are a ton of Dominicans, but across the country that's not necessarily true. And so I think that same with anything, it's just, you know, as the number of Dominicans grow and as more opportunities kind of arise for Latinos to fill those roles, mm-hmm. hopefully there will be more Dominicans, but right now there are a few.
Now, do you feel that, I mean, did you ever think that working at a New York Times for a Dominican writer, journalist such as yourself was a fantasy, or was there a sense of that this could be real if I just put in the work? Because there's really no data to support that it's an easy ride for a Hispanic to just go to the New York Times.
Yeah. No, I mean, honestly, for me, my entire career has been a dream. I think that, and literally, like, there are things that I have, they are things that I've dreamed of, but never things that I expected to come true. And in particular, the Times, you know, it just felt so distant. And I remember when I was maybe, like, 17 or 18, I wrote this like satirical essay for school, and my teacher was reading it, or a writing tutor or something was reading it, and she was like, "Oh, like this is so good, you should submit it to the Times."
Oh wow!
Like, what? And at the time, like I didn't know anything about media. I didn't know how to like pitch people. I didn't know how to submit anything. I don't even know. But I sent it to like someone at the Times. Of course, never heard back. But since then, I think I was just like, oh, I'm not good enough for the Times, because obviously I wasn't thinking like I'm 17 years old and, you know, I need some years in me before I'm able to write mm-hmm. at the level required to work at the Times. But, you know, I've always been an admirer of the Times, and I've read a lot. I used to read a lot of their articles before I started here, and it just felt, I just think we have so many talented writers. And so I was like, wow, like, these are great writers. There's no way that you know, I'm going to get there. And if I do, then it's going to be in many, many years. So it's definitely, it was a surprise to me. And
how did you prepare for that? How did you prepare your writing to be at the level of the Times?
Oh, I don't know how to answer that. Because I don't think that I did anything like active to prepare.
Got it. You didn't go to like a writing school. You didn't have to go get a master's degree in that. You didn't have to take tutors. You didn't have to go into online writing and try and copy a particular structure. You didn't hire, you know, tutors, maybe ex reporters from the Times. You didn't do any of that, right?
No, I didn't. I didn't. You know, I was always a big reader, and I'm a big believer in reading as a form of improving your writing. So I feel like I grew up with a really strong foundation for writing, because I was like a voracious reader. Like, I would read like 10 books every 2 weeks, literally. And so I think that's a huge part of it. That's a lot of books. Yeah, that's a huge part of it. I honestly think one of the experiences that really kind of formed my writing was going to an advanced high school. So I went to Bard High School, early college in the city. And it's basically you know, exactly what it sounds. It's an early college. So essentially you go in and you do 2 years of high school, and then the last 2 years are college, college classes, excuse me. And so you graduate with a high school diploma and an associate's degree. And what was
incredible.
Really lovely about it was that, yeah, it was incredible and really a great experience. And I feel like, by the time I got to college, I was like, this is cake, you know, because I have been so thoroughly prepared. But yeah, you know, we got to pick our classes. I took philosophy classes and sociology classes, things that high school students would not necessarily have access to. So I will say that, like, that wasn't an active thing that I was doing to prepare to work at the time, but I really kind of credit that for forming me and kind of helping my writing get to a place where I can write for the times. I feel like I still have a lot of growth to do in terms of writing. I don't think I'm like the best writer in the world. But I definitely think those were, those two things were things that I can think of that really helped me more, like stuff from when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I take a lot of writing classes now after having started at the times.
Interesting.
Just to sort of continue to work on it. Yeah.
Oh.
But it's mostly like I take a lot of creative writing classes to do, to write. At some point I'd like to write a novel. So a lot of the writing classes that I take have to do more with plot and form and working on those, on that discipline.
How did you get into journalism?
So when I first graduated, I wanted to be a book editor. And so I was applying to all these book publishing companies and did not hear back from one. I mean, literally it was like putting my resume into a black hole. And I was like, okay, well, I guess this isn't for me. You know, I need to kind of figure out something else to do. And I had been a Chinese major, in addition to a Spanish major. And so I was like, well, maybe I'll look for jobs that relate to my Chinese language skills. And so I found a job.
Do you speak Chinese fluently?
Oh, it's so funny that you mentioned that. I definitely not fluently. Which is very embarrassing because, you know, like I said, it was my major. But, you know, after I graduated, that's like, what, 7, 8 years ago maybe now?
Uh-huh.
My math is terrible. But after I graduated, I just haven't spoken it since then. And
right.
So very recently, actually, I started taking a Chinese class because I'm like, this is embarrassing. Like, I need to get back into this. So I'm trying to build it up. But at the time and when I first graduated, I applied to work at a Chinese company and ended up becoming a consultant for them for a couple of years. And so I did that. And it was interesting and it was cool to be able to use my, you know, my Chinese language skills. But then I kind of just realized that I really wanted to go back into the book world or publishing in some capacity. And so I applied for the Columbia Publishing course. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No.
But essentially, it's one of those, it's a 6-week course, and it's split between book publishing and media and magazine and journalism. And so the first 3 weeks, we had a whole bunch of sort of professionals in the book industry come to talk to us. And it was like, you know, people that were editors and publicists and worked in the marketing department. And it was really interesting, but it kind of made me realize that the book publishing world in itself wasn't really for me. And then the media people came and I was like, yes, like these are my people. It was just much more fast moving. It was, there was much more of a generation of ideas. With books, they were like, oh yeah, it takes like a year and a half or more to work on this one book. And I'm like, I cannot work on one thing for that long. And so I just found the media industry to be a lot more dynamic. And that was really appealing to me. So that was, I would say, was my entry into the industry. And then I did a couple of internships. I ended up working at Glamour Magazine for a couple of years. That was my first job in journalism. And I was an editor there. I ended up, by the time I left, I ended up editing the Work and Money pages, and which is essentially like, you know, stories about personal finance and career, obviously catered to like women because it was a women's magazine. And then once I left Glamour, that's when the opportunity to work at the Times came up. And then I just like interviewed and here I am.
So you never worked for a Hispanic platform?
No, I didn't.
Is that something that you regret not doing, or is that something that you'd like to eventually do, or is that something you don't even think about?
No, I mean, I tried. I like pitched some Latino platforms, but I mean, at the time I was so new. I didn't know how to pitch. I didn't really know very much about the industry, and so I tried, but I wasn't, you know, the particular platforms that I was pitching to weren't really receptive to it, again, because I probably didn't know what I was doing and didn't know what I was pitching. So, but I, yeah, I mean, I would love to, I mean, I'm happy at the Times now, so it's not like I'm looking to leave, but I'm certainly open to it. I think that reaching a Latino audience is really, really important to me. And often when I think about my work at the Times, I am bummed sometimes that it's so separate from like my family. And I really think a lot about how to sort of build a bridge between my work life and my family life, which yeah. because those feel so separate sometimes. So yeah, in response to your question, I certainly have nothing against, like nothing, I'm not opposed to it and I'm open to it. But for right now, I'm chilling at the time.
There is this sense that when you're a Hispanic, and you're working within the Anglo sort of media world, that you're not allowed to almost carry your stories, the ones that you also follow and that you're very passionate about, a particular song or J Balvin, and you want everybody else to kind of share in that joy that you have for your culture. And when you're kind of either told no or there it's ignored, there's a certain sense of emptiness in you, and I can totally empathize now. For you, why do you think there aren't enough Latino journalists in mainstream media? And why do you think there aren't enough Latinx platforms like El Space? Why isn't this abundant everywhere?
I think that's a big question. I think that in part it has to do with pipeline. You know, I don't think there's a lot of access or opportunity available to a lot of people. I know that even for me, like I said, when I first graduated college, I was applying and applying and I had no one got back to me. And it's because particularly when it comes to journalism and media, and I don't know if this is true of television as well, but my impression is that it is, it's so hard to get your foot in the door if you don't know anyone or if you don't have any sort of connections. Mm-hmm. And what I was only able to kind of move forward in the field once I knew the right people and had people that could kind of, advocate for me and put my name in the bag and
so you had a rabbi
in front of people. One person in particular that I think I owe all my jobs to, and has been really instrumental in that. But I think a lot of people don't have access to that, you know? And I've spoken to some young journalists, or I have in the past, who have kind of expressed interest in media and have talked to me about how to get into it. And I'm like, honestly, it's so hard if you don't know people. And know people that have power, right?
Because, so how do you do that then?
Well, for me, it was I did the Columbia Publishing course. So the person that was able to help me a lot was the director of the Columbia Publishing course, Shay Earhart, who, again, was the person who sort of sent me to the right interviews and kind of helped me just helped me get a seat at the table, you know, mm-hmm. or not even, I think a seat at the table is probably not the right phrase. Cause I don't think I have a seat at the table yet, but just help, you know, just help me get interviews essentially, like literally just get an interview, not even get a job, just get an interview, which mm-hmm. I think is so challenging. So I think that was the way in for me. I think for other people, it can mean different things. You know, you can ask editors out for coffee, writers out for coffee that can give you advice there. I did some of that as well. I think it can feel disheartening because that can take a really long time. Because you have coffee with someone doesn't mean that they're going to give you a job. I had coffee with, you know, like at least 10 people before I started the course, the Columbia Publishing course, and none of it ever led to anything, you know?
I think that one of the biggest problems is, for example, I grew up in Queens. I'm not sure where you grew up and what neighborhood.
Same
thing? Okay. So yeah. I was born in Flushing, lived in Jackson Heights for many years. Moved to Woodside for a while, and the idea of working in Manhattan was just, you know, it was the movies. It's not really yeah. meant for someone from Queens, from Jackson Heights. So at some point, your aspirations sort of are numbed out, and I'm trying to figure out, where did you get the drive and the motivation to stick to this and not Some a lot of Hispanics stay in their bubble because it's a comfort zone, and as soon as they have to confront challenges or rejection, that's when everything discombobulates. Where do you get? Is it from your parents constantly telling you that you could be better or that you're great, believing in yourself? Not everybody does that. Where did you get your drive?
So definitely from my dad, I was raised by my dad, and he was incredibly demanding, I think, and really expected a lot from me when it came to school, when it came to academic success. So I think that was a part of it. And I think that's true of a lot of immigrants. I don't think that's super unique to me, but I think a lot of immigrants that come to the U.S. expect a lot from their kids because they kind of put all of their, it's like putting all your eggs in one basket, you know, they're like, we made this journey, we sort of came to this new space so that you could have a better life, and so we expect the best from you.
True.
I think that's one part. The other part, I think that I think my high school really not only prepared me for a lot of things, for in terms of like getting my my writing ability to a certain level, but I think also put me in proximity to a lot of people who didn't feel as limited as I did, and who kind of opened my worldview to a lot of different careers. So I come from a very working class family, and so I didn't have sort of the idea that I could be a writer didn't even occur to me, you know, as a possibility,
right.
Until I met people that did kind of, that maybe had parents who were professionals, that had parents that were accountants, that had parents that like were doctors or did different things. And so that was part of what kind of opened up my mind to that. But honestly, I feel like I didn't really think that it was possible until I did it. And that was 5 years ago. You know?
Just do it.
So I always find it hard to give people advice about this because I think there's no clear path is one thing. I think that I didn't get a master's degree, but I think often for people of color, master's degrees can be very, very helpful because they can give you access to spaces that you wouldn't otherwise have access to, you know? I think that I was able to do that through the course that I did. I think, you know, a master's degree is a way to do that. And also to give yourself the confidence that you, to sort of feel like you can do it.
Right. Backing it up, the validation of that degree. Right.
Exactly.
Where no one can say, well, you're not qualified enough. And I go, well, what about that master's degree from Columbia?
Exactly.
Thank you so much for being a good role model and for taking the time out. I know you're really busy and sharing, your path to where you are now.
No problem. Thank you so much for thinking about me for this. It was really great to talk to you.
And that's it for episode 108 of the Highly Relevant Podcast. I want to thank Maria Elena Fernandez and Concepcion de Leon for coming on the show, and I hope you guys enjoyed the conversations as well. If you'd like to support the show, please spread the word on social media and pass the word around to all of your friends. You can reach me on Instagram at Jack Rico and Twitter at Jack Rico Official. Remember, it's only through your support that our show can grow. I'm Jack Rico. See you next week on another episode of Highly Relevant.